Hey, welcome back to Invisible Machines. I'm Josh Tyson, a contributing editor here at UX Magazine. I'm joined again by our resident visionary, Rob Wilson, CEO and co-founder of OneReach.ai. Rob and I are co-authors of the best-selling book, Age of Invisible Machines, and this podcast here is where we continue our explorations of agentic AI. Today, we're talking with Matt DeBergalis, CEO and co-founder of Apollo GraphQL. For anyone who's not familiar, GraphQL is an open source language for APIs working inside of an agent runtime. And as a quick side note, if you haven't checked out the recent episode that Rob and I recorded about agent runtimes, find it in the feed. They are absolutely the missing piece in today's AI projects. As for GraphQL, in a nutshell, it makes data fetching more precise and more flexible. Apollo GraphQL is a market-leading API orchestration platform, and Rob and I were excited to talk with Matt about why GraphQL spreads so quickly among developers and why it is such an excellent fit for AI. As you'll learn in this episode, building your own tools gives you an enormous edge with agentic AI, and GraphQL helps teams move light on their feet, experiment freely, and adjust course quickly. We also reminisce a bit about the early days of the internet and narrowly avoid talking about back pain. Enjoy this dive with Matt DeBergalis. Matt, great to have you on the show with us. Thanks for coming and joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is awesome.
Well, Matt, we thought it would be maybe useful to get started by talking a bit about GraphQL, and sort of what it represents, and then also kind of the convergence right now. That's kind of an exciting moment for GraphQL with AI agents and
unsung hero. Like, I don't think people realize like where this sits.
The unsung hero of this moment. Yeah.
I think it's all going to happen pretty fast too. So
yeah,
I'm in San Francisco. I have never seen excitement and energy like this in my career around agents in particular. I mean, AI obviously got very hot, but the agent thing really kicked off with MCP this year, and it's just been, it's incredible. Like, it's incredible. I think people, the thing about agents is they do stuff, and I mean, I don't have to tell you, right? But like, I think that's so evocative for people, whether you're building the technology or scared shitless or anywhere in between, right? It sort of forces you to have an opinion.
Pretty sure in between is where I'm excited.
I'm excited, but there's a lot to figure out. GraphQL is a query language for APIs. That's the basic idea, right? So,
But it's also one that, in my experience, and I would say in-depth experience, it knows very well. It's quite proficient. And compared to other languages, like query languages in particular, not that there are others that necessarily do the same thing, but it's quite proficient.
It's super interesting. I mean, people have thought for a long time about how to make APIs work better. And there's been a whole series of technologies that never really got off the runway, designed to bring more structure and heft and capability to APIs.
Right.
And I'm, you know, we talk about AI in a sec because that's different, I think, in some ways, but it's fascinating to me what wins and what doesn't win with developers. And, you know, why did GraphQL win? Why did it spread so fast in an area where a lot of stuff hadn't? And I think so much of it just comes down to what you were getting at a second ago. It's got this really magical set of properties that developers love. Like, it has types. It's strongly typed.
Yeah.
So if you're used to building apps, you don't think about APIs as having types at all, but now they do with GraphQL. And if you have types, you can build tools. And so there's this really nice tooling that comes with GraphQL that none of the other stuff had. And I say all that just because it's what's going to make it such a good fit for AI, in my opinion. And I feel very lucky about that. I didn't, you know, some of this we saw coming, some we didn't, but it's certainly positioned exactly where you need a bridge to APIs to be, I think.
Yeah, I have two lenses. I'm always looking through the technology lens and then the design lens. And when I look at APIs through the design lens, you know, I would say that it's not a interface for machines, it's an interface for developers. And generally badly designed. Not well designed. Early day internet UX of website bad. And GraphQL is like the Apple design standard that like that makes it unified and makes sense. And you're like, well, who doesn't like good design? That's why, because we need good design. It's so cryptic to read API docs and figure out what you're supposed to do with it. And the fact that only one person has to go through that and then they can make a UI on top of it for everybody else in your organization to not have to go through that. Who doesn't want that?
A traditional API isn't really designed for usability, is my take.
Right.
So you end up with developers. Developers are good enough at this that they can make it work, but it really limits how much stuff you can build. A layperson's not going to go call a bunch of APIs and make a piece of software that talks to the world and does things. We need that because now with agents, I think lay people are going to build this stuff, and that's why we're here.
Yeah, it's a good point. The developer, what is that? What is that 5 years from now? Is that a word? I was thinking the 70s, right? You're a computer operator in the computer department. You're probably a woman. 80% chance you're a woman. Now you use a computer. Are you in the computer department? No, there's no computer department.
You're in the bathroom. Yes.
Yeah. Is the developer department? Is it just we're all developers? There's no word anymore, developer. There's just smart people that think logically and are responsible for certain processes and not. How long does developer stay a thing? That's a good question. Let me throw that at you.
Well, there's a lot of different kinds of work developers do. I hear people throw
I don't mean they're not busy.
They'll
be busy and working. Yes. I don't want to give the impression I think they're going to be out of work. I think they'll be busy and in demand, just doing different things.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a class of development, maybe look at it as the job instead of the person, right? There's a class of development stuff that I think is going to go away. You know, the art of assembling things on a screen, I'm not so sure. And that's not even just because of AI. There's so many great tools now that make it possible to put together a great user experience. And I think there's other stuff that's going to be here for a long time, right? I don't see procedural software disappearing tomorrow. I think we're still going to have services.
The opposite. It's going to be
it's going to
be generated on
the
fly. Every transcript is going to be a new application. Yeah, we're going to have so much it's going to come out of our ears.
This episode is brought to you by OneReach.ai, the runtime for AI agents. Their GSX platform provides turnkey private architecture and tools for building enterprise-grade agentic solutions. Recently, I worked with the team at OneReach to create an agentic companion for the second edition of Age of Invisible Machines. So now when you scan any of the QR codes found in either edition of the book, an agent is there to provide additional insight using a custom knowledge base. There's also a newsfeed feature with updates on agentic AI, as well as this podcast, and a book resources skill that provides clickable galleries of footnotes from each chapter. All of it built using the revolutionary Generative Studio X platform. Learn more at OneReach.ai. If individuals, like lay people, as you said, start using AI agents to scale up activity with all these different tools, that kind of changes the nature of software and who makes software and what a business is if a business buys software or makes their own, like all these things start to kind of swirl and become in flux, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, we have, I think this is true everywhere, but we have lots and lots of people that aren't part of our engineering department that have been doing exactly that. And it is software, right? They're building processes and workflows and assembling systems together, and it works. It's valuable. We rely on it. Sounds like software to me. I don't know.
Yeah. But,
they may not think of it that way. And it's definitely a different discipline, a different set of tools. That's the vision. I think that's the dream. I don't want to live in a world where all of our software was written by a, you know, there's a stereotype, right? Of like, who makes the software on your phone? And like, what's their background? And I think that as a consequence for the kind of stuff we use every day, and I'd rather be in a world where the software I use comes from people with a lot more broad perspective and different takes on things.
I think it's like software may not be built by people, but it'll be designed by them.
Yeah, like, it'll become maybe
because
disposable,
we want
but
it
you
to.
Don't ever
not
want it
because
to.
it's better or worse, because that's what we want. It's like stories. Stories can be written, but we still want people's stories. We want their stories, not the endless story from a LLM.
We'll see.
Yeah, we want human stories.
We'll
still want design, I would imagine, right? Like even if software is being designed ephemerally or created ephemerally by AI agents, there still has to be some element of design trickling down through it.
Yeah.
Right?
Go ahead.
I mean, one way to look at it is it's just a tool, right? I mean, your compiler is a tool. I haven't written assembly in a long time, and it'd be pretty slow if we had to.
Right.
And, you know, so you still have to know what you want. And you have to be, I think that's design, right? You have to be explicit and directive, and you have to edit. And I know I'm at my best at work when I'm editing, you know, improving something rather than when I'm, you know, writing a V0 from scratch. And I think a lot of this stuff lets people elevate their work that way, and avoid some of the more esoteric, you know, you don't have to know how the adder works in your processor to make software today. So it's a better computer, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that we already make a lot of software no one uses anyway. Why would we stop? We're gonna keep doing that because we like making it. We like that. We like the process of making it. We like the process of cooking. So yeah, you can get Uber Eats every night, but we like cooking. We're gonna keep cooking. And I just don't.
Yeah.
I find all this stuff silly. Like just because it can, that it will. That I don't. I just, nothing has gone in that trajectory. Like it can, sure.
I'm interested in the software that gets used by one person. Like there's all this stuff that I want personally. I'd be perfectly happy if I was the only person who ever used it. That's just not practical today. I'm busy and like a lot of people are in no position to do that. But like just all this stuff, what it's your hobby or just something that makes your life a little better.
That's a cool idea. It's software designed, like all your software designed for you. That's cool.
I mean,
we don't use all the same things. We use our things. It was designed for me. It's my software.
Yeah.
Well, that was like a
mind
shift.
And you're
going
to hire people to design software for you, just like your house. You're going to hire an interior decorator because you're like, oh, you have good taste. Can you design some of my software for me? And they'll design software for you, though, not for everyone in your company, for you.
So I have a my big hobby is I'm a pilot. I fly a little plane. And there's all kinds of software I'd love. But the thing that was on my mind a second ago is like if you go to an airplane mechanic, but mechanics own their own tools. It's interesting. Like if you go work at a shop, you bring your Snap-on chest and they're your tools. And a lot of these guys have made tools over the years. Like they'll take a a box wrench, but they'll grind off one end of it because there's one bolt on one particular model of whatever where you can only reach it with this like funny thing, or they'll weld another thing together so you have this weird offset thing. You know, like great, I think great tool makers like to make their own tools to help them make stuff, you know what I mean? And now we can do that with software. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I do too. In some ways, you just made me think it's sort of similar to 3D printing in that what does it give us? Like,
yeah, totally.
We don't all have to get the same shit now.
Yeah.
We can, and when we want the same stuff, nothing.
Yeah.
We'll get it. But when we want
small,
it.
Small batch.
Yeah. Like yeah. Just in time, small batch, just for us. And if you step back and think like, does it make sense? Well, do we love the software we have? Like, is it perfectly designed for us? Like if it is, then we won't want it, but it's not, you know, it's not perfectly designed. Cookie cutter from a UX standpoint, trying to build a UI for everyone is designing a UI for no one. It's the most commonly said thing in the design space. So this idea that these things can be customized makes a ton of sense.
That's the first thing we're going to see. Like, I think it's really exciting that agents open the door to a much more freeform experience where when I, you know, I don't know, like a bank, right? Like if I go to my bank's app and you go to the same bank's app, it's adapted to each of us. And, you know, just think about all the fussy little things on the screen today. And I don't know, I open my app and there's some big graph because I guess some product manager thought there needs to be a big graph. It's not what I want when I like crack open my banking app. Like I wasn't looking for charts, but you see why it happens. And then there's stuff I do want that I can never find, or maybe it doesn't exist at all. And it would just save me a lot of time and stress. That's coming. We know how to build that today, right?
Yeah, and a la GraphQL, it's not just your bank stuff in that interface. It might be your shipping stuff and your shopping stuff, like, because you don't care about the back end and who the supply, you care about the workflow. So you're like, well, I don't need a siloed app for my banking. That should be part of my retirement planning. And I just want one app that covers all of it, just like your house has different rooms in it.
And I think it's going to be very interesting to watch who gets comfortable fastest with, you know, that this idea means that companies are going to become call them capabilities, right? Like if you think about a bank, right? A bank has a capability, which is, I guess you can send ACH with a number on it and they'll hold the money for you and you can get it back in different ways. Like, and you know, today the only way to get access to these capabilities is through their software or through some sort of integration they've built. Like ACH is an example. I can do it from another, you know, from PayPal to my bank or the other way around. But if you get comfortable exposing the actual capability, which is what GraphQL is all about, it says like here's the nouns and verbs of my business. Here are the rules. Here's the behavior. Here's the documentation. When we talk about GraphQL, that's what we're talking about. And if you expose that, it'll be interesting to see, because I think for some companies, that's the core value and the prize is unlocking as much of that as they can because they want more and more people using those capabilities. Maybe for others, you know, maybe they don't see that as a strength and they're in a mindset of we've got to control the experience. I don't know, like early Twitter was all about the API.
Yeah.
Yep. Later Twitter was not about the API because it's ads. So I don't know. I can't see far enough ahead to play it all out, but who's going to run the ads might be another way to ask the same question, right? Like who's going to pay for all of this and what's the form factor of that going to look like? I don't know.
Yeah, I think two things in there. One, ads as a business model is it's a whole area to explore. And yeah, to your point, it's an unknown because it's a bit like you almost see ads as like a hacker and virus software. It's like a cat and mouse game. Like they're trying to hack humans to buy their products. And so whatever you do to not see the ads, they're going to find a way to, so you can't predict where it's going to go because it's hard because they're always trying to find a way to get the ad in front of you when you don't want it there. And then you're always trying to figure out how to get shit free without watching the ad. So, okay, well, everyone, I'll try to figure it out. TiVo, here we go.
What I want is freedom. I want, that's why I make tools. I want to enable everybody to build what makes the most sense. I don't know what that is for any particular company, right? Like, but I want a world where those, where everybody has options. And I think that's a big role of infrastructure, APIs in particular, right? The plumbing of the internet. It's all about what you can do. And I know some of this AI stuff definitely makes me think about the early internet where
it's free form
again, right? Like and you can mash stuff up together. I remember mashups, like that was a thing for a while. And I don't know, maybe it's just because I was growing up when that was going on, so that's the thing that's at the end of the day I'm gonna want to come back to. But I miss it, and I think here's a chance to see some of that kind of flourish again in an even bigger way.
Yeah, and like if I was to connect with anything, the biggest pattern for me is the excitement again. The excitement I had with the internet and how fun that was. And then going into this, I realized how not fun the internet became when everybody else, like in all the minutia case. I'm not saying it's not fun to have other people, but it was, there's some sort of like, it, you know, maybe I just got used to it, but I feel like that feeling's back, that excitement. Yeah. We were talking to, he's the head of innovation at ServiceNow yesterday, Josh was referring to, and
Brian Solis.
Yeah, and he was kind of saying like, he's an optimist for the future, right? And I was like, well, wouldn't you have to be if you're a futurist? Like, who would want to be the nihilist futurist? You know, like you wouldn't want to look into the future. You have to kind of be an optimist, and I think it's the same thing here. When we look forward, we get to get excited about what it could be, and that's fun.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like that feeling's back. It's giving me excitement and energy again.
That's the vibe.
Well, I feel like organizations too, or maybe once they come to realize it, right? Like kind of like Klarna, it hasn't been easy, but they decided that they didn't want to be precious about someone else's software anymore, right? Like a lot of companies are used to that, of like having to accommodate to these kind of rigid software systems. And now they're in a moment where they can still in a way be more precious, right? Because they can design specific systems for what they need and what they want. And that's obviously where a lot of these tools come into play. The organizations have so much flexibility, and individual users do as well. But I think organizations might find that they're closer than they think to kind of being unbound in a way.
Yeah. And Klarna had a big impact on the industry when they first talked about the experience they had. What was that? 18 months ago, a couple of years back now. Fine. Gosh.
Yeah. A decade ago. I don't know.
I think a lot of people are feeling a real urgency here. And I think that urgency leads to a willingness to take some risks and be more creative. And I think that's also been a source of energy, right? Like it's one of those situations where you know you don't know where things are headed. So the smart move, I think, in a lot of people's minds is to create a culture of experimentation and innovation, a more permissive culture. I talk to a lot of large companies because here's the other thing about GraphQL. It models a graph, right? There's objects that relate to each other. Graphs have a network effect. The big ones are really valuable. If you think about a multinational, or if you think about a company that's been built on the back of an acquisition strategy. Like they've done a bunch of M&A. They've got all these different mini companies, mini software systems that the graph lets them glue together. There's a ton of, like, in hospitality, you see this a lot, right? I started out as a hotel. Now I also have a car rental thing. And the hotel has a restaurant. And I'm trying to monetize, like, all sorts of different things. And my customers want an integrated travel experience, right? So, like, how do I glue this to that, to the other thing in a way that makes sense? And Graph makes that possible. So I talked to a lot of these people who are, you would think of as maybe more conservative and measured about their software strategy, but not with AI. With AI, their take is we have to get really adept at this, and we have to be willing to make mistakes. And they talk about a lot of it is culture work. A lot of it is about creating the conditions that are amenable to super fast progress. So yeah, that's the other ingredient here is you've got a bunch of people who've explicitly been told, go be excited and innovative and like, don't sweat it yet. I'm sure the other shoe will drop, but right now that's the right thing to do. And it just keeps, you know, adding to the energy and momentum you were talking about.
You got it, boss. I'm on it.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so I just to get a little geeky here, graphs on the ground solving that problem, like that abstraction layer for reals, right? And an MCP is a little bit of an idea. And you talked about that fine-tuning, like typing, right? That fine-tuning capability that developers want, not because they just like things for no reason, because it's useful. And so if I look at, like, you know, machines querying GraphQL, machines automatically connecting into GraphQL, and then MCP somewhere orbiting around in all of this. Help me fit these pieces together in a more cohesive way.
MCP is what makes AI into agents, right? It's the way they talk to the stuff. So if you want your AI to actually order you a book or book you a flight or, you know, ask a question that requires calling into some software. What's the weather going to be tomorrow in like Astoria, right? Like those are all examples where the AI is using MCP. And here's the way I think about it. What makes AI so good at what it does is that it's non-deterministic. It's free form. It doesn't always behave the same way. That's its strength. It's, you kind of want that in an agent and you kind of don't, right? Like,
you don't want to talk to a robot.
Like, if you think about what's a great agent experience, I want to feel like I'm talking to something that's like adapting to me, right? Maybe they adapt to my pace of speaking or it understands my like nuance when I ask for something. It's so amazing. I mean, you've all had this experience, right? You can type a pretty clunky question into a modern model and it'll understand what you're really getting at, right? So that's good. The bad part is when we're connecting it to the rest of the world, we don't accidentally want global thermonuclear war, right? Like we want to contain this thing a little bit, and we want it to, we need to stand on something that is deterministic, where like if I imagine an agent that's going to do a financial transaction for me, I'm not looking for free form at that level. I want it to behave exactly the same way every time. That's the GraphQL part. GraphQL is a way of describing the objects, right? So in a GraphQL setting, you're going to have like an object called like bank account, and it's going to have certain properties like current balance. It'll have a property like recent transactions, which returns a set of objects that are, you know, money went from here to there. You can kind of picture in your head what the object model might look like. That object model in GraphQL is precise.
Yes.
It's documented. There's actual English language. This is part of GraphQL. There's English language descriptions of what each object means, right, what each property means, like means
which
to a person.
Which just inherently makes it useful that we found to him.
That's why these things work together. If you connect an AI to a random API, it gets this flood of data back, and the data doesn't really explain itself
because APIs
historically didn't have to. Right. And where are the docs? Who knows? Like, are the docs up to date?
Yes.
Do the docs match the API? I don't have the data, but anecdotally, I would say rarely do the docs match the APIs.
Yes. And how long does it take to get them? And,
exactly. And so if you think about an AI trying to understand whatever that means for the AI, reason about these objects and what you can do, all the things that developers liked 5 years ago about GraphQL, oh, the docs are up to date. Oh, I can like click on an object and like hop around because there's structure to it. It's essential. It's essential for the AI. So hey, this is all my take, but what we've seen so far is if you pair all these up, if the models use MCP to talk to a graph and use that graph as really the, it's an abstraction, right? It's the,
yes,
the abstraction and description of everything that the company can do, all the APIs that are underneath that. Magical stuff happens. It works, I think, is the punchline. You get what you want. It doesn't hallucinate the way it does when you feed it a bunch of extraneous stuff that you often have in APIs. It's evocative. You watch this happening and you just think, gosh, you know?
Yeah, that's how we use it. I mean, we use it extensively, Graph, and we didn't have the term guardrails. Everyone's using those now. Fine, I'll go with it. But it would be like an MCP to an agent, then an agent to Graph. And Graph acts as much as many things, access, and it acts as guardrails. It protects those decisions you said that are unintentional by the prompt writer, right? And people say, like, you know, I think a lot of people think of guardrails as like a thing or a model or something that evaluates the output. But guardrails is just all the software we've been working on to, you know, and all the functions that make it safe that we've been adding. You know, guardrails is in your graph if you did it right. And so if you just put an agent in front of the graph, your guardrails are there. They're already in there.
There's another angle, though, which is the graph connects stuff together.
Absolutely.
So
if I'm
looking at one part of it, I can hop over to another thing, right? That's not like closing one book and going over to the other department and getting their API book and opening that one. It's right there. So there's guardrails, but there's also, it's like the web, right? Everybody's first experience with the web. You click on a link and then you're like, oh, that's interesting. You click on the next link and
yes.
2 hours later, you're reading some Wikipedia article about like the fourth crusade or whatever. Right. But you know, it's all there. And that's
it's
just
a really
that's
good
the
point.
Same thing.
Yeah, it's the. I think I've noticed a lot of people. If you're on the ground using agents, and you've done a lot of deployments, you start to realize that, like people, they tend to have a limitation of how well they work, given the number of choices they have. I think a lot of people think of it as like, oh, it can do. It's AI. It can make a lot of choices. It can make good choices from a big number of options. And in fact, even though that's true on a word by word basis, it's not actually true on an idea by idea basis. And so if you give it, you know, 100 choices of where all the data is, it's actually going to fail almost every time. And you have to simplify its choices so that it works, and narrow its number of choices. So by being able to, we call it omni-data, but by being able to say, oh, you need data, go to omni-data, not here's the 10 different possible spots and query languages that you'll have to go, it'll fail, but giving it like
balls.
One place, giving it one choice means it will it will make the right choice more often. So again, people are calling that guardrails. To your point, it's way too simplistic. It's more than that. It's finding it. It's being available. It's like enabling. It's far, far more. But at the end, what does someone get? The right data. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Matt, the way you describe it, it almost feels like a digital twin. Like when we talk about digital twins of organizations, obviously that's like a multi-layered thing, but the GraphQL is almost a layer, right? It's like a representation of
digital
all the
twin
tools
of your structured data, yeah,
available to an agent within an organization. And that's guardrails and then some, I guess.
Yeah.
Designing graphs then it's a whole art.
More than like might like.
More art than
going
science.
To that. I mean,
yeah. Did you come into work wanting to paint, or did you come in wanting to get something done in a predictable amount of time, right?
Like, right.
A little bit of art is good. Too much art, we try to steer away from.
Yeah. I mean, just like what data should be available.
Yeah.
How should it be available? What is the art? It's understanding, empathizing with who's going to use it. I mean, if you don't know how it's going to be used, it's very hard to design.
This is the whole magic of GraphQL. So every API technology before GraphQL basically came out of the backend world.
Right.
Right. And so you can think of it as like, We gift you, application developer, the following thing, right? Like what you do with it is your thing. And GraphQL, and you can go back to the earliest, you know, Facebook blog posts that talk about this. Like it's designed unapologetically for the needs of the person who's calling the API, for the application developer, or now for the agent, right, in today's world. And yeah, the art is about, hey, I've got all these APIs. What do they mean? So I have to name them. Like I have to, right? What are the, there's a set of very hard things in computer science, right? Naming.
Yes, like naming variables.
So
yeah.
That's the art. It's like, is this a product? Is this a customer or a user or a person? Like often you end up with, if you've got a lot of APIs already, there's going to be some overlap and some ambiguity. We've worked with a lot of retail companies. So pretty much every retail company has APIs that return product information. And you'll usually see, you know, they'll have like an AS400 or something in the back of the store that returns the bin information, like how many whatevers are on shelf 15 of aisle 70, right? That's like one system. It's got a name for that product. Then you've also got maybe a modern cloud thing they've built on Elastic or some kind of, you know, modern search database that's designed really for SEO. So the product names are different. Same product. There's some commonality there. They probably have the same SKU or UPC code, or there's going to be something that connects those worlds. But when you're designing a graph, you have to ask like, well, what do these mean? And do I want both? Or am I trying to bring them together? And the thing I was getting at a minute ago when I said we don't want there to be too much art is we are in the business of shipping software, right? Making tools for people that need to ship software. And so we don't want that conversation to go on interminably. We're not looking for a philosophy or a thesis. Right. We're looking for a product that gets shipped.
Yes.
So I try to be pragmatic about this stuff, and we're starting to learn like what are the right patterns? How do you give people a starting point to move quickly on things like that?
Yeah. Because
there's so much value when you do it. Like it turns out both those product representations are important. And if you can expose them to the right people, so you're not using the wrong one in the wrong place, it makes your software a lot better.
Yeah. I mean, anybody, and this sounds like I'm tooting your horn, but I really mean it. Anybody who has a good implementation right now has a huge advantage.
Yeah.
with
that's true.
Take leveraging agents. Like I'm sure it in ways you never even predicted, you know?
And that's where platforms shine, because the puzzle for a team that's been asked to go do a bunch of AI very quickly is I need to be light on my feet. I've got to do a bunch of experiments. I don't know what's going to work, right? I don't know what product my customers want. I know the models are all going to change underneath me as I do it. So there's just not a lot of stable ground to work from. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you would hope that some of the experiments do work. And if you find something that makes sense, like Klarna did, right? Like if you find an agentic user experience that you do like, and you get comfortable with how you've built it, you're going to want to ship that. So I think platforms are how you square that circle, because it lets you move fast and experiment, but at least you're building on a firm foundation, so that when you get to something good, you're not, you don't have to start from zero to do it for real. You've actually right. done something that you can leverage. And I think that's just the story of standards and open source and platforms and ecosystems, right? They all give you that that leg up when something really new and disruptive like models and MCP now comes along.
Last time we talked, you were saying, from your vantage point, you just see a lot of excitement, a lot of meetups around MCP people. And I wonder, like, if you could just share, what's the dialogue about? I mean, what are they talking about?
It feels very early web to me. It's there's like 3, 4, 5 MCP meetups a night here in San Francisco. It's bananas. And a lot of it is showing that you can connect things together. A lot of it's about, here's a piece of software that you've seen here. I've made it MCP, and look what I can do, right? I can talk to GitHub, or I can, like in English, I can ask like, which repositories of mine have the most traffic on them? Like who's excited about what? And using MCP to kind of browse the world's APIs that way is, I think, at the heart of a lot of what people are demoing. MCP itself is changing very rapidly. Auth is a major topic. There isn't yet a complete story around that. Maybe by the time we distribute this conversation, it'll be more sorted. But I think, everything about MCP is evolving. So there's a lot of the kind of plumber, hacker stuff that's going on there. And I think there's just a general sense of like trying to figure out where all this can take us. I've started seeing cool demos of like new kinds of user experiences that you can build with that. Like people are feeling around in the really early days for what that looks like. It's also a tribe, right? A lot of this is about people meeting each other because they want to work with other people that are as excited about it as they are. And this is the easiest way to find that.
For us, MCP was an idea. An idea that people, I'll be honest, really argued with me on most of the time. and not MCP as the specific protocol, but the idea. And I said, machines are going to talk in natural language. We're not going to see the typical API interactions.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many people said no. The inventor of Siri said no. Nope. It's gonna stay. I struggled with why it made so much sense to me that this was gonna happen. But what is fascinating is that all of a sudden everyone changed their mind. Obviously, I was just not very compelling at telling the story, but all of a sudden everyone just changed their mind.
I think what happened is the demos showed up. AI is a very demo focused culture. And think about it. Like ChatGPT was just the mother of all demos, right?
It was. You're right.
And different topic. But anyway, so, you know, it's not like MCP is the first time people thought about selling out to something external from your LLM infrastructure, right? Like OpenAI had functions, and I think LangChain in a lot of ways is just an earlier version of this, but this happens all the time in tech, right? You have versions of this kind of stuff, but then eventually something comes along that has the right essence of it, the right simplicity. MCP is really, like all great protocols, it's really simple, fits on a couple pages. There's not much to it. And that meant that, I mean, you could argue A to A from Google is a much more interesting technology. But right now, MCP is the one that a typical developer can throw a demo together with fast.
So simple.
Show that off to their teams and their friends. That gets people interested because it's visual, it's interactive. Like it's hard to unsee that once you've seen it.
It is.
You go from there.
Yeah, there's some trend here going on where it's simple to take. It needs to be simple for people to get excited and for it to take off. But then as we use it more and more, it gets complicated and then it gets less fun.
That's reminding me, like, Rob and I had a really interesting conversation recently with Cassie Kozarkov, who is Google's first and former chief decision officer. And we were kind of talking about complexity and how organizations really need to be able to embrace it. And as you were describing GraphQL kind of in this retail setting, it's sort of occurred to me that it's almost a tool for confronting complexity in a way. Like if you are building a GraphQL, you're having to make those decisions. Like, how do we describe this? Like you're able to confront complexity in a real hands-on way, which I think is really powerful. And then what you're describing, it like it starts to create that, maybe not the why, but it gets you closer to there because you can start to get a sense of what you might be able to accomplish. Is there any truth to that?
I hear people talk about, I hear people talk about the power of visualizing all these objects and how they connect together. I think like being able to, because that's the other thing, APIs, they're not really for humans, certainly not the insides of an API, right? But the graph very much is. It's visual, it's interactive, you can click around it, you can look inside the objects and see what it's got. And if you're a product manager or designer, it connects you a lot closer to the ground truth of what you're building on top of than these wacky REST APIs ever did. So, and especially, I mean, it's interesting, like, we hear this story over and again, like, your typical developer at a big company will say something like, I don't even know what APIs I have access to. They have no idea. People have been trying to build different systems that catalog these things at least, but it's amazing just how distant this stuff is at a big company that has 30, 40, 50 years of stuff they've built. I mean, that's complexity, and it's good. Like, that's why the company's worth something, is because they made stuff that's useful. But being able to draw a circle around it and say what it is and do that in a friendly way where it becomes available is a real joy to watch happen.
Yeah, I think that's the other area of MCP that'll be interesting and fun to see evolve, because that's a big piece too. What's available? That's like, I see folks that are like building these, I don't know, if then, and you know, if this, then that, or Zapier, like MCP, you know, servers that abstract a bunch of APIs so that you can just talk MCP to Salesforce or whatever. Still feels to me like taking our old paradigm and trying to apply it to this is like, I don't. Just give me the source code.
I agree. Yeah. There's a world of integrations, which is different from like software, the way we think about it. They're both important. But I think historically, at least, they've been separate. You build those things in different technology stacks. There's different priorities, different requirements. you know, we come from the software world. We come from the people that, you know, think about I'm shipping an app on the phone or a website or, you know, whatever it is, a kiosk. And, you know, it's got an expectation around quality and completeness, and we call it the illities, right? Like all the must-have characteristics in the enterprise. So yeah, I think agents and MCP may give us a way to bridge those worlds more closely, because I think like software in the traditional sense is going to look more and more like what we were talking about before. And I think the integration stuff is going to look more and more real, because it can do more. So that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, this was great. I enjoyed the chat. I still hold to, I think that people are underestimating the power of graph in this world. It's going to play a huge part, I think, in well, what do I think? I think there's a lot of companies that are looking at agents from like the front ends, from the user interface standpoint, and just saying like, let's just start by taking all our APIs and abstracting them. And the best way to do that is graph, and then on top of graph, MCP agent. And its only job is to communicate with those systems. It's not to answer customer service. It's purely just to do a good job of operating GraphQL. And I think what happens in that world, I think that's the singularity, in my opinion. That's what singularity is. It's the idea that anything can talk to anything.
It will be a very interesting next couple of years.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
to
great
say
chat.
The least, right? Yeah. Thanks, Matt. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast too on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog, and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the U.S. and in Ukraine, Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokolkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week, Owagi.